This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers. Hey, everybody, it's Jessica, and this week I'm so pleased to bring you an interview with Dan Morin. Dan covered California politics, policy, and justice-related issues for more than four decades, including 27 years at the Los Angeles Times and 8 at the Sacramento Bee, where he was the editorial page editor. Today, we're talking to him about his fantastic book, Kamala's Way, An American Life. He brings insight into Kamala Harris as a person, as a candidate, as an office holder that I've rarely heard before. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. As always, please rate, review, and subscribe. Dan Morin, again, author of Kamala's Way, thank you for joining us here on Passing Judgment and for spending a few minutes to talk to us about the presumptive Democratic nominee to be president of the United States. Did you predict that we would be here talking about her as the almost certain nominee to be the next president of the United States?
Well, first of all, Jessica, thank you so much for having me on Passing Judgment. It is among my regular podcasts, so I appreciate it so much. Who could have predicted it? I think anybody who followed Kamala Harris' career trajectory knew that she was going to run for president at some point. I thought it would be 2028. I really did believe President Biden when he said he was going to run again. And then he had the horrible debate performance, and we all know what the fallout has been from that. So, yeah, I knew that she was going to run. I didn't think it was going to be 2024. But here we are. What an extraordinary time we're living in.
Now, people who haven't yet read Kamala's Way, and I want to commend it to everybody as necessary reading going into this election and after the election, no matter what happens, I absolutely think that this is an indispensable book because she will be back. Even if she doesn't win, I think she will be back. So I know you talk about this in the book, but when did she first get on your radar? When did you first start hearing the name Kamala Harris?
Well, it goes back to 1994 when I first heard her name. She was obviously friends with the then Speaker Willie Brown, and he appointed her to a state position. So that's how I knew her. That's 30 years ago. Much has changed. I got to know her during the presidential campaign. I covered for the LA, helped cover for the LA Times, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, John McCain campaign in 2007, 2008. And she was one of the main surrogates for Barack Obama in California. She was in Des Moines. We watched, or I stood not very far from where she was standing, watching Barack Obama's victory speech in Des Moines before he headed out to New Hampshire. And then I got to know her much better when she ran for California Attorney General in 2010.
You said much has changed, and I think we could take that two different ways, both with respect to everything outside of Kamala Harris, but also with respect to her. And I'm just wondering, in watching her evolution as somebody who was a surrogate for Barack Obama, as you said, to now the presumptive nominee, again, to be the next president of the United States, what do you see as the biggest changes in terms of her as a public figure?
Well, it's certainly no secret. I obviously did not cover the Biden White House. And it's certainly no secret that she was cuffed around quite a bit early in her time as vice president. A lot of attacks from conservatives, Fox television, you would expect. But also many Democrats who just thought she was not ready for prime time. I don't know if they were Biden partisans or whoever. But at any rate, she had a rough go the first 2 years as vice president. As I read, again, I didn't see any of this firsthand. What I see now is what I recognize from California. I mean, big smiles. She's having a She seems to be having a good time. I mean, obviously, she's under a ton of pressure running for president. It's the biggest political stage of all. But she looks like she's having fun. She looks like she's being quite authentic. She's a good politician. I mean, she had a terrible run in 2019. Her campaign went awry. She stumbled multiple times for a variety of reasons. But what I saw when she ran in 2010 and when she ran for re-election in 2014 and when she ran for the U.S. Senate in 2016 is somebody who's a good politician, good at campaigning.
What makes somebody good at campaigning? You said she's a good politician. I nodded my head and I am seeing what you're seeing, and I defer to you on all things Kamala Harris. But then I'm wondering, what is it that I'm seeing apart from she really does look freed? And I think part of that is not having to go through a primary. It's more than that. So what do you see as somebody who's covered politics for decades? Why is she now a good politician, a good candidate?
Yeah, well, she's in charge. She doesn't have to worry about the attacks from the left. You know, this is not, I mean, obviously she's left of she is a left of center politician, but she's not as far left as many in the Democratic Party. And because of her time as deputy district attorney and as in Alameda County and as an assistant district attorney and district attorney in San Francisco, I mean, she's a prosecutor. That's how she grew up. What makes her a good politician now is she's got one target and she's homing in on it, Donald Trump. And, you know, obviously she has to sell herself to the public. She has to show the public that she can do the job, that she's competent. But, you know, she's got a pretty big target in Donald Trump, and she's very good at taking on one opponent. I think it would be the sort of thing that you would know better than I would, but having covered courts, a good prosecutor is very quick on her or his feet, is very good at asking a pointed question and really getting to the heart of the issue. I think you see that in her. I think part of what she's doing here is prosecuting a case, and she's comfortable doing that. She seems to really like doing that. You know, we all saw her in the Senate hearings, the confirmation hearing for Brett Kavanaugh, or the hearings where she was questioning, really tough questioning of Trump's first attorney general, Jeff Sessions, and then the second attorney general, Bill Barr. She really tied him up in knots. She's good at what she can do, which is ask a good pointed question. I wouldn't like to be on the witness stand being cross-examined by her, I don't think.
Well, it's interesting because it does seem like from my outside perspective that events have kind of coalesced to allow her to be that prosecutor, right? And she's able to say now in a way that she couldn't in 2019, I'm the prosecutor, he's the felon, let's go. And you did mention that her campaign for the 2020 election faltered. And I'm wondering, just because history can always repeat, if you could talk a little bit about what you saw in terms of what the greatest weaknesses of that campaign were, and why, after that huge announcement in Oakland and tens of thousands of people were there, she ended up pulling out before one vote was cast, before California, her home state, ever had the opportunity to vote, because the polls didn't look good for her.
Yeah, she wouldn't have won in California, and she certainly would not have won in Iowa in the caucus. So she pulled out in December of 2019 before her name was on any ballot. You know, all I know is I did not cover the campaign. I tried to reconstruct it for Kamala's Way, and I certainly talked to people who were involved in it, not her. I should say again that Kamala Harris did not help me with this book, and nor did her family member, Maya Harris. I mean, none of them talked to me for this book. But I talked to people around her, and it was a mess. She had a muddled message. She couldn't figure out whether she wanted to be a tough prosecutor, which was hard at that time, given who she was running against. All of them were more liberal than her, except for Biden. And so she stumbled. She stumbled on healthcare, which was obviously a very key issue then. It's a key issue now. But I think she would have a direct answer for that now, I would hope. So she could stumble on some policy or another, but she's been vice president for 4 years. She's had a lot of time to think these issues through. I guess I'll just be surprised if I see that kind of stumble. I think more likely what we're going to see is a kind of candidate we saw in California running for Attorney General at U.S. Senate, who was very confident, who thought she could win, who thought she had every right to win, that she could do the job. I think that's who we're seeing now.
It does look like we went back to earlier elections. Again, you are an expert on her. I am not. But this does look like the person who thinks I can win and we're going to do this. And, you know, buckle up. This is going to be fun, as opposed to other moments where she's looked somewhat pained and I think not as confident. I would like to keep going back a little bit and focusing on Kamala's way in the book and talk about something that you'd mentioned earlier, which is you got to know her earlier on, and she was a surrogate for Barack Obama when most people, particularly most people in the Democratic Party who were particularly ambitious, were for Hillary Clinton. And I also heard you say, yeah, we knew she was going to run for president. You're not surprised that she's running for president. Maybe the timing is surprising, but I have heard this from people who know her well, that clearly this was her aspiration. And I'm wondering, and just in terms of us trying to learn more about her, why do you think that she did become a surrogate for Barack Obama in that race when the establishment plus more were behind Hillary Clinton?
Well, that's true. Gavin Newsom was supporting Clinton. Senator Feinstein was. Yeah, Hillary Clinton had certainly had most establishment Democrats supporting her in the 2008 campaign. Why'd she support Obama? They had met when she was district attorney. I think she really liked him. I think he liked her. I just think she was more attuned to his politics. And it also, you know what, it set her apart. Everybody else is for Clinton. As the district attorney of San Francisco, well, you know, you're maybe not going to get very much attention. You certainly will get attention if you're supportive of the newcomer, of the upstart Barack Obama. And if he loses, oh well, but what if he wins? And so she, you know, it was a risk. I've written, when I worked for the Sacramento Bee, I wrote more than one column critical of Attorney General Harris for not taking stands. But she certainly, she was a little too cautious for a reporter's taste, perhaps, you know, with probably smart politics. But she certainly took a stand with regard to Barack Obama that was a gamble. And it paid off. And he certainly helped her when she ran for California Attorney General in 2010 at a time when she needed the help. So it is certainly the case that she made a risky call then, but ultimately, for politically, the correct call.
Do we see that duality in her a lot, where there's a risky call and then obviously that one paid off? I'm guessing not all of them did. And then there was, and I remember this criticism of her, and I obviously read all of your columns, and I remember you saying this as well, that she was very, very careful, to the point of, I think, frustrating the public at times, not just reporters, but frustrating voters who really wanted to know her views on certain issues, particularly related to the criminal justice system, which was in her lane. And I'm wondering, in somebody who, again, has chronicled her career, do we see that oftentimes where sometimes she's willing to jump and say, I'm going to be at the forefront? And other times, do we see her really hanging back to take the temperature of the public, look at polling, hope that she's not going to make a decision that could come back to haunt her? Is one tact more than the other, or is it just situational?
Well, so you think about when she was California Attorney General, there was a ballot measure to basically soften California's three strikes and you're out sentencing law. And as your listeners will know, this was this was a law where you could get sentenced to 25 years to life for a crime as small as shoplifting, right? And people, in fact, were serving time for, you know, possession of small amounts of methamphetamine or for shoplifting, and they were doing 25 to life. It was a pretty tough law. She didn't take a position on the initiative that softened that. Well, you know, if you're the top law enforcement officer in the state, you as a voter, at least this is what I would argue if I were an editorial writer or a columnist, is that you really ought to know what the top law enforcement officer thinks of that measure. The same with death penalty. There were two ballot measures, one to abolish the death penalty and another one to, in theory, speed it up. The one to abolish failed, the one to speed it up passed. She didn't take positions on either one of them. And there again, you might expect your top prosecutor to do so. Her argument was, well, her deputies might have to defend it in court, and she did not want to taint their arguments. Reasonable position to take, I suppose. Annoying if you're a journalist. But, you know, past attorneys general had taken positions on ballot measures. She was doing it differently. She was doing it her own way. That said, there are a couple cases where she really was out in front. And I think of one in particular, and then a second one, if you have time. But one in particular is a case involving Backpage.com. Well, Backpage.com was like Craigslist, only for prostitution. Worse, it was minors were being trafficked on Backpage.com. It operated across state borders, all 50 states. No attorney general took on Backpage.com until Kamala Harris came along, and she took it on. And Backpage, like X and like Facebook, claimed it was merely a bulletin board. It could not be responsible for what gets posted on its site, a Section 230 exemption. And so she challenged that. Federal preemption notwithstanding, she challenged that. She ultimately, my recollection is, lost on the federal law, but she got guilty pleas against the proprietors of Backpage for essentially pimping and put them out of business. Well, that was a big deal. Nobody, no other state in the union did that. No other attorney general, not the most conservative Republicans, and certainly not the most liberal Democratic attorneys general. She did that. I think that says something about her. She really cared about crimes against children. She cared about sex crimes against children. This mattered to her. And this is the big tech state. And yet she was willing to challenge this exemption that every tech company had supported. And some of the, you know, internet freedom people were claiming that she was going against this, you know, sacrosanct law. She thought about kids who were being trafficked. Says something about her.
You said if we have time, there's another example. So I did want to ask you about another example. And then I just had a few more questions because you know her like other people don't know her. We watch her on TV and we read about her. But I want to end with some things that you wish we knew. But first, the second example.
Well, so the other example was, you know, at crisis pregnancy centers are obviously these are places where women go who are pregnant thinking that they're going to get some help. And it ends up that they're basically counseled to have their baby if they can't keep it, given up for adoption. She sponsored legislation when she was attorney general that would compel crisis pregnancy centers, most of which are, maybe all of which, I don't know, are run by conservative Christians, to post a statement saying that essentially to get reproductive health care, go elsewhere, right? If you want to get an abortion, basically go elsewhere. Well, you certainly would know this better than I would know this, but that's compelled speech. And so, of course, conservative Christian law firms filed lawsuits against this, and it went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and Clarence Thomas wrote the opinion in which he said, indeed, this was compelled speech. And then the law firms, because they had brought this civil rights case, ended up collecting about $2 million in attorney's fees from you and me and the other taxpayers of the state of California. You know, so this was a gamble she took and she lost. If you read the legislative council's analysis of it, even the legislative council wasn't 100% sure that this would be legal, constitutional, race questions. Jerry Brown signed the bill. I don't think he necessarily thought the bill would survive. He signed it anyway, and that's what happened. California lost, and there's a big case called, I think it's NIFLA. I forget what NIFLA stands for, versus Becerra, I think is the name of the case. So it's a First Amendment case, and California lost it. So that's the other example.
I teach that case in my First Amendment class. So Dan, you use those two examples. And in the first example, you said, and I think that tells us something about her. So I'd like to ask a different question that might get to learning a little bit more about her, which is there's obviously a lot of reporting now about the amount of staff turnover she has. And I know that you haven't been reporting on her time as vice president in the same way that you did in her earlier career. But is this a pattern that we see from her, that there is a lot of staff turnover? Is this because she's a particularly difficult boss? Is this because she helps to support people moving on to higher positions? I guess what I'm just trying to explicitly ask is, does she play nicely with others?
From what I know, from what I'm told from her days as Attorney General, she could be a tough boss. And some people did really well under it, under her as a boss, and some people left. And there are hard feelings out there, without a doubt, without a doubt. I also know that she surrounded herself with some really smart people who have excelled. So she picks smart people and to be around her. I think that that is true, without a doubt. And also, there's no doubt but that many of the people who she started with in the Biden White House moved on, are no longer with her. There was a lot of turnover. Now, there weren't too many people from California who she brought with her, right? So these are people who maybe didn't know her particularly well, didn't know her style. But yeah, sure. I mean, I certainly know from her days as California Attorney General that some of her political appointees felt that they couldn't stay and left.
Dan, you literally wrote the book on her, Kamala's Way, An American Life, and you have insight into her that the rest of us just can't and don't have. And again, for everybody, I really want to recommend the book as such a smart read on who she is and how we end up seeing the woman that we see today, who might be the first female president of the United States. And in our closing moments, I'm wondering if you could tell us, what is it like to be in a room with her? What have you noted in terms of following her career for decades that the rest of us probably don't have the opportunity to experience? I mean, is she the person we see on TV and in rallies? Is she different one-on-one? Is what we see what we get?
Well, so she came to the editorial board of the Sacramento Bee when I was an editorial writer and later when I was editorial page editor. And she knew the issues. She knew what she thought. She was really charming. She had come to the editorial board right after one of my colleagues, Jack Ohman, had won a Pulitzer. And he of course, was off busy doing something, didn't attend this board meeting. But she wanted to see his office, which was a mess. Jack's office is a mess. And she went out of her way to sort of look at it and make note of different messes. And she left him a sweet note. I mean, it was like, she could be so charming. Mm-hmm. You know, she was absolutely engaged. Of course, my recollection is she brought a staffer with her when she came to the editorial board, but it's not as if the staffer said, excuse me, Madam Attorney General, let me help you with that answer. None of that. She knew exactly what the answers were. I should say that journalists being journalists, we ask questions and want answers, and politicians being politicians sometimes don't want to answer the question. And so you could ask that same question 10 different times, and she will patiently say, no, I'm not going to answer that. So she's very good at answering questions, very good at not answering questions one-on-one. The one time we had lunch together, you know, she's quite a foodie. This is well known, and I believe that this is 100% the case. Anyway, the place she chose was a little hole in the wall across the street from the Capitol, served Caribbean food. And it was lovely. It was wonderful. And you know, she talked about the spices. She talked about what we were eating. She chastised me for eating too quickly. but it was lovely. There were a couple times when sort of out of the blue she called. I mean, this is something that I think smart politicians do when they're trying to cultivate a journalist, is call and just kind of, you know, without a particular agenda other than to make a phone call. And of course, I was, I don't know, flattered, thought of a few questions to ask her. I mean, she could be, you know, she could be very good, and she can be, you know, really tough. She's got she had a thick skin when I knew her. It's no doubt gotten thicker after 4 years as vice president.
My recollection is that the last time you and I had a meal about 10 years ago, you ate at a completely normal speed, or in comparison to me, it was normal. Dan Morane, author of Kamala's Way, An American Life, thank you so much for coming back. And thank you for being so supportive of me. As I mentioned, we did lunch 10 years ago. You have been endlessly supportive of my endeavors, and I'm really grateful for your time and grateful for you bringing us this insight.
Great. Well, thank you so much for having me, and I look forward to the next episode of Passing Judgment after this one.